You know, it's quite an emotional upheaval for me to be back in this place. 20 years ago, Dr. Morton Smith and I used to sit and dream in our offices in Belhaven College about such a seminary. I have not been back to Jackson for 15 years, and now I suddenly find myself, through the courtesy of the Eastern Airlines and Delta Airlines, to be back in Jackson as of last night at 9:05 or something like that, George, as I remember the time I got 9:30, I reckon it was. And today, to lecture to you on Calvin is a joy to my heart. And so, Dr. Freud has asked me to make the transition from Zwingli and Luther to John Calvin. But may I make first some introductory remarks concerning the nature of the Reformation. I would have you remember, ladies and gentlemen, for that the Reformation was born on the wings of sound scholarship. I cannot emphasize this enough, that learning and great theology, great evangelical convictions, the great evangelical fervor, and even bravery and martyrdom are not foreign to the Reformation, but they are all part of the story. We see Calvin fleeing from France. We see Archbishop Thomas Cranmer putting out the hand to be burned first, because that was the hand which betrayed his Lord. We hear Bishop Larimer and Bishop Ridley crying out to one another as they are being burned at the stake by Henry VIII. These men, without exception, were great scholars. The evangelical world then was floated by divine mercy and divine sovereignty on the wings of great scholarship. And desperately, the church needed it then. Desperately, the church needs it today. I can hardly tell you how I feel about coming to this faculty, meeting new friends, seeing old ones, and seeing, yea, indeed, one former student of mine in this place, and knowing that here, as in very few places in this country, you are getting high biblical sound scholarship. Don't ever come to the place where you believe that you cannot be a great evangelical minister and not be a profound scholar. I would cite to you Thornwell, Dabney, Palmer, and the other great leaders of our church, the Southern Church at one time. I remind you of the Hodges and the Alexanders and so on in American church history to support this thesis. Time does not permit me to recite the list of those who led the Reformation who were equally great scholars. Secondly, and in all due fairness, I must bring this to your attention, that the Roman Catholic Church of the 16th century, as bad as we admit it to be, and indeed as bad as we insist that it was, nevertheless, by divine mercy and divine sovereignty, nurtured within its bosom its own Reformation. Every one of the men whom you will be studying with Dr. Freund, and maybe you won't be able to cover them all, I don't know, was nurtured in the bosom of the universities of the Middle Ages. And may I point out something to you just in passing, this is my weakness, that the Middle Ages contributed the whole idea of a university. It was not a Greek, it was not a Roman, it was not the Egyptian contribution, it didn't come out of the classical period. A university could never have come out of the modern period. We have multiversities, but we don't have universities. The Middle Ages had universities. And any university that could claim St. Thomas Aquinas as a member of its faculty must earn our respect. And not only did the University of Paris claim him, but they had his great friend, John of Vedenza, Bonaventura, on the faculty at the same time. That indeed merits our respect. But the medieval Roman Church produced, by the divine sovereignty of God, its own Reformation. These men were scholars. I'm sure that Dr. Florence has brought this out in regard to Martin Luther, and I would take up at this point. Now, when we study and when we look at Martin Luther, we are overcome with his greatness. And I would say nothing which would in any way disparage the greatness or the grandeur of Martin Luther. I would say nothing. I would give him all credit for what he did. A man who had tremendous courage. When you see him meeting at the Diet of Worms in 1521, and when you see him approaching the Emperor Charles V, he was approaching the center of political power in Europe. And you see the papal legates surrounding Charles V, and Duke George of Saxony, and Duke Frederick the Wise of Electoral Saxony. You see the assembled political power of the Holy Roman Empire, and you see a monk being summoned to approach the imperial throne. And then you hear him say, "Here I stand, God helping me, I cannot do otherwise." You're in the presence of greatness. You're in the presence of real spiritual and Christian greatness. So anything I say would never be to disparage Martin Luther. And yet, if I were to end the story at this point, I would have to say that if Martin Luther had been the only reformer to appear, we would not have had a Reformation. And it would not have been the Reformation that it became. Now, why do I say that? To disparage Martin Luther? No. Martin Luther spoke for Germany. Martin Luther knew the German mind. Great modern High Deutsch, High German, began with Martin Luther's translation of the Old and New Testament. Luther was a scholar, but he had the unusual and the unique ability to understand the German mind. Thus, in his speaking for Germany, he cut himself off from speaking for the French. He cut himself off from speaking for the Swiss. He certainly couldn't ever really speak for the English, let alone that breed from which many of us sprang, the Scotch. He was so German that he was the man that God chose for the German Reformation. And his whole career brought him to this point. You may remember that when finally Leo X sent von Miltitz to find out what was going on in Germany, von Miltitz understood what the others didn't. And when he came back to Rome, he tried to tell Pope Leo X some of the facts of life. Namely, that Luther was a German. He spoke for Germany. And that Leo X had better change his tactics if he were to meet the situation in Germany. But Leo X, being Leo X and being a de' Medici, he didn't change. And nature and history and God took their course. But Luther, speaking for Germany as he did, brought the German Reformation as God's instrument into being. But he would never have brought the Reformation, as you and I know it, into being. Now, I say this with no intention of diminishing his greatness or what he did, but I would remind you of some things about Luther. Luther was a curious combination of physical and personal boldness, even to the point of being audacious, and a curious kind of theological timidity. Now, undoubtedly, this was a brilliant mixture for the needs of Germany of 1510, 1512, down to the end of his career. You know, the popular statement in Germany was, the nearer to Rome, the further from Christ. The further from Rome, the nearer to Christ. With a little twist to it, Germany was furthest from Rome. Therefore, Germany, in the eyes of many Germans, was the nearest to Christ. And Martin Luther, I don't mean to use the word capitalized, but this feeling floated around him and centered upon him in a very interesting way. But secondly, his theological timidity caused him to take the attitude that he would break with Rome as little as possible. You know, until 1526, he invoked the blessing of the Virgin Mary. I don't say this in criticism particularly, although I don't agree with it, but rather to show you that he did not shed his Roman Catholic background easily. Many Lutherans love to use October the 31st or November the 1st as their date when Lutheranism was born. Luther was not a Lutheran on November the 1st, 1517. He was a frightened monk. He said, with what madness would I do this thing? With what madness? How could I possibly attack His Holiness? And he did it with fear and trembling. He disagreed violently with some of the concepts of papal indulgences. Most all of them, as a matter of fact. But he wasn't a Lutheran. Only gradually, through the great help of a man who had been badly neglected, did Luther come to see what was really in the offering. And that man was von Staupitz, his spiritual advisor of the Augustinian order. For many years, I've been asking my students when they go to graduate school to please do a biography and a theological insight into von Staupitz. 2 years ago, a work came out, not by one of my students, because they neglected to take this advice. But he has been badly neglected. He stood behind Luther bravely and in a spiritual manner, and the correspondence between them is overwhelming to read. However, Luther broke only gradually, and Lutheranism retained much of the aura of his Roman Catholic background, even in regard to his views of the sacrament of baptism. And then there's a third point I would bring out. Martin Luther had a long and tempestuous conversion experience. Now, whatever view you accept of when it began in the events of 1505 after he received his M.A., incidentally, he stood second in a class of 17, so that tells you something about his abilities. Whatever you think about that, Martin Luther's conversion experience was at least a 10-year or 11 or possibly 12-year experience in which he grew. But in which he grew according to the most recent spiritual upheaval. Luther's theology was coined to meet a series of spiritual upheavals. He didn't suddenly become an evangelical when he went down to Rome on the mission for the Augustinian order and von Staupitz to the Pope. As you may remember, he did. He went down, and you know what he did? He rode a donkey for 800 miles. That should have done something to him. I wouldn't ride a donkey for 800 miles to see the Pope or anybody else. And then he rode back again. And he had a lot of time to think. But he didn't come back and say, the just shall live by faith and suddenly become a Lutheran. This helped him. And what he saw in Rome disturbed him. No question about that. But what was he doing? He was slowly developing spiritual crisis upon spiritual crisis. You may remember in 1505 when he suddenly, I was beside myself. When he celebrated his first Mass, he said, only with great restraint could I avoid throwing the sacraments on the floor. And that would have, of course, been blasphemy. Petrified, disheartened, at sea, with himself, not knowing where he stood. It was at this time that von Staupitz said to him, my son, read St. Augustine, but above all, my son, read St. Paul, and read St. Paul again, and then read him yet again. That was the message to the distraught Luther. Gradually, Luther began to be a Lutheran. When he finally became it, I'm not going to say, I have my own feeling, I would say certainly by 1520, he came into full, at least into a great deal of light, which would make him a Lutheran. However, the point is this, that it was 10, 11 years. He coined his theology to meet a succession of emotional upheavals, which did not come in a systematic order. And his theology reflects this emotional background, if you look at it carefully. So therefore, Luther's theology, while evangelical, and in many points great, lacks a systematic character. He could not speak to the crossroads of Europe. He simply could not do it. As a result, if Luther had been the only reformer, we would have had undoubtedly a tremendous and tumultuous upheaval within the church in Germany No question about it. But it wouldn't have affected Switzerland. It wouldn't have affected England to any great extent. It would have had very little effect in France, very little in Hungary and elsewhere. It might have gone to Norway, Sweden, and Denmark because they were Teutonic. Luther spoke the Teutonic mind, fine, but partial. And so, the Reformation was waiting for its leadership to come. Now, very briefly, I understand you've been through Zwingli, but let me, if I might, give you my evaluation of Zwingli. Zwingli has long fascinated me, partly because my wife is descended from him, and therefore prudence demands I be fascinated by him. However, I do not share the opinion of Philip Schaff in regard to Zwingli. Zwingli approached Christianity as the perfect philosophy. Luther approached Jesus Christ as the Savior who must answer my tormenting guilt, my tormenting sense of sin, and answer my immediate spiritual problems, which were many. Zwingli is hunting for a philosophy. He is hunting for the philosophy which will bring the crown to his Thomistic training and background at Vienna and elsewhere. In my opinion, Zwingli was able to get away with what Luther couldn't in his fuss with the papacy, simply because he did it philosophically. Now, I am not saying he did not finally become a Christian, but I am saying that certainly in the early years of his career, he was the philosopher in search of the perfect philosophy, and he decided that Christianity was the perfect philosophy. He did not come, as Luther did, with the overriding sense of guilt. He didn't come with that long spiritual upheaval which characterized Luther. He didn't come with much of Luther. Now, personally, Zwingli was brilliant. He was much more systematic in his thinking than Luther was. He did not know church history as Luther did. Luther did know his church history and knew it well. Thus, Zwingli had one other great failure. He was never able to shed a double role. He was at one time a theologian and the next time the leader of battle. Zwingli did not have a single track mind of a single zeal. Luther did. Zwingli did not. The result is, of course, that Zwingli died in battle. And again, if the Reformation had had to depend on Zwingli, it would have been a truncated movement. Now, if you look at the record carefully, you will find that Zwingli left no real great creedal position behind him. He left no real church behind him. He left a confused and disorganized Switzerland, overcome by its political enemies. And so, with this background, as an introduction, as a transition, I would bring you to Calvin. And once again, I would bring you to the point that Calvin, in his birth in France, had a peculiar place in the Reformation. I think we're forced to see that in all the Reformation, the Lord had a divinely appointed role for these men, a sovereign role, different and yet each fulfilling certain great roles. I am willing to concede, I am not diminishing the greatness of Luther. Undoubtedly, although Calvin never knew Luther, that the influence of Lutheranism had a great effect upon the coming of Calvinism. And now let us look at John Calvin. 1509. That was an interesting year, wasn't it? Have you ever stopped to think about that? That was the year that Henry VIII came to the English throne. Two very dissimilar men, to put it very mildly. But Calvin was born when Henry VIII ascended the throne. What a contrast in that year. At the age of 14, may I remind you again of what I said? At the age of 14, Calvin entered the University of Paris. This should bear some significance. If I were teaching my class in Reformation history at Catawba College, I would take the time off to point out that at that point in our history, we had universities and we had great education. Today, we don't even have a reasonable facsimile thereof. To think that a 14-year-old boy would be ready to go to the university and could appropriate what that university had. Now, many scholars hold it. I will admit the chronological possibility. that Ignatius Loyola may have sat in the very same classes with Calvin at the University of Paris. But may I point out again, this much maligned University of Paris, and it was in bad shape, comparatively speaking, in 1520, when Calvin went. I'll admit that. I would still insist that a university which had had Jacques Lefebvre on its faculty, and which had Calvin and Ignatius Loyola in its student body, and could turn out reformers of their quality, was not totally dead. It had not totally yielded the Saturday afternoon football spectacle. It still had great professors on its faculty. It still had students who come to the university for the purpose of learning and not to be went with, who those have come there to go with someone who wants to be went with. It was still an intellectual institution and a great one. And so we see Calvin receiving the best training of the day. For the University of Paris was the great central seat of learning at the period of which Calvin, in the period which Calvin was there. Now it was not as good as it had been, but it was still a great school. And all sincere young students looked with longing eyes to being in the registrar's line at the University of Paris for what it could offer. He went there at the age of 14. And think of it, students. You were bound for the ministry. Here he begins his work for law to please Daddy Calvin, but always with a secret yearning in his heart to enter into what was known, of course, then as the Roman Catholic ministry. He graduates. He goes to law school, studying under the best law professors in Italy and in France. And then he's not a Christian. This is the amazing thing about Calvin. His first great work was on Greek ethics. And there's not much Christian about it. In fact, there's nothing really Christian about it except a profound knowledge. He's not converted. And then he says, and we're not sure the date, he says, all of a sudden, my life was changed. And Calvin, the Greek scholar of great ability, becomes Calvin the Christian. And then a very significant event takes place in his life. While he was at Paris, he met a young man, a good friend of his by name of Mr. Cobb, whose father was personal physician to the Francis I of France. Now, we do not know the story, but young Cobb was named Chancellor of the University of Paris, possibly through royal pull. But young Cobb is not in a position to write his inaugural address. And I cannot explain what happens. I've examined the documents, what there are. I do not know, and I don't know any historian who does know. But William Cobb apparently decided he'd get John Calvin to write his inaugural address. And Calvin apparently gladly did it. And Mr. Cobb read it before the faculty, the chancellor, the principals, the rectors of the nation, the University of Paris, the assembled student body. And in it, he enunciates justification by faith. Within a very few weeks, Paris was hunting for a new chancellor. And Calvin was no longer at the university. Now, this is a remarkable situation. In 1512, Jacques Lefebvre had been called, or as you may know him, Faber Stapulensis, had been called to the University of Paris to teach Aristotle. Now, Faber Stapulensis, or Jacques Lefebvre, was teaching Aristotle in a very new way, out of the Epistle to the Romans. And in 1512, Lefebvre begins to lecture on justification by faith at Paris. Imagine, in the citadel of Thomistic scholasticism, in the citadel of all that Luther had protested against, Lefebvre, who was never being suspected of such terrible tyranny or treachery, suddenly begins to preach. And you know who heard him? young Mr. William Farrell was a student in these classes. Now, we're brought face to face then with Calvin the Reformer. Now, many great facts stand out, but one fact is this, which I must point out to you at this point, that Calvin, unlike Luther, did not go through an agonizing 10-year period. His conversion, as far as we know, was an instantaneous work of grace, where Calvin, the Greek scholar, with his Stoic background, becomes Calvin the Christian. This eliminated this emotional period in his life, so that he didn't have to begin where Luther began. He didn't have to go to the scriptures for every emotional upheaval as they come along, and as they did come along for Luther. Calvin suddenly emerges. Now, he's not the full-blown Calvin. He's a well-trained scholar with a degree from the University of Paris and a law school at his beck and call. He is now a scholar. He wanders around Europe, as does Jacques Lefebvre, for exactly the same reason, they're homeless, as the others. And then he goes to Geneva. He didn't intend to go to Geneva. I mean, he went there for a little while, but if you know Europe, he really wanted to go up to Strasbourg to see an old friend of his, Nietzsche. But he goes to Geneva. The year 1536 is very significant. In that year, Erasmus lay dying, despised, neglected, rejected, and theologically and philosophically homeless. In 1536, a papal commission makes a report to the reforming Pope Paul III, calling for reform within the church. In 1536, Calvin goes to Geneva and signs up at the Holiday Inn for an overnight stay. His young friend, the convert of Jacques Lefebvre, comes to him and says, "John, I must decrease that John may increase. Stay at Geneva." And Farrell shook his head. He had long fingers. And he shook those fingers under Calvin's nose and said, "The Lord has called you to Geneva." But Calvin says, "I'm going up to Strasbourg." And Farrell says, "No, you're not. You're staying here." And he stayed. Now, in 1536, Geneva, in its moral life, was a combination of Hollywood, Miami in the winter, New York at all times, with a dash of Chicago. It was morally rotten. It was noted for its debauchery, its drunkenness, its adultery, its crime. It was a center for all of this. And Calvin didn't want to stay there. In fact, he didn't want to go. He wanted to go up to Strasbourg. But you see, he stayed in Geneva, because speaking through the servant there was the Lord Jesus Christ, who had called Calvin to Geneva in spite of Calvin's reluctance. Now, Calvin has what Luther didn't have. He had, first of all, a great training. Luther had a great training. But he had an instantaneous conversion, which eliminated Luther's upheavals. He had a consistency and a logical mind, which Luther did not have. And he had both a physical courage, but he also had the theological and the intellectual courage in combination. Thus, there was nothing timid about Calvin. There was not that timidity which at times marked Luther. Luther was a curious combination. To see him at one point standing before the Emperor Charles V with all the combined might of the Holy Roman Empire, And then realizing at the same time how timidly he gave up his Roman Catholic background, how timidly he advanced into evangelical truth, how he decided that only those things which were strictly forbidden would he forbid. And then in Geneva comes Calvin with just the opposite attitude. You see how the Reformation is built up. By the way, I meant to ask you, if you have questions, I'm used to questions, and if you have questions, let me have them as I go along. I'm only trying to give a survey, and this is hard to do, and I hope I'm doing what you want me to do. Now I would invite your attention to Calvin and the Institutes. Trained in the best education that Europe could afford at that time, trained in the school of the Lord, of which there's none better, coming to Geneva, and if you know your map of Europe, Geneva, even more than Jackson, was the crossroads of Europe. I've lived in Jackson, and I know that Jackson's the crossroads, and I love Jackson. I love the people in Jackson. And I certainly would not say against Jackson. I love the place. And I have maintained many, many close friends in Jackson. But I do love Carolina. I have a friend here from Charlotte. I don't see where he's from. Anyway. Geneva was ideally located to fan out the Reformation into France, into Germany, and eastward, over beyond Switzerland, southward into Italy. It was because it was the crossroads. It was the crossroads linguistically. As you know today, Switzerland is, with its at least three major languages, which are all part of the Swiss tradition. So that Geneva not only needed Calvin, it not only needed Reformation, but it was the place to be the center from which reforming influences would go all over Europe. Now, let us look at Calvin for a minute as it begins his work. You've heard it said, and I've heard it said so many times, he was cold-hearted. He didn't care about people. And Luther was warm-hearted and cared about people. Well, now, neither one of these statements is entirely true. Luther had a magnetic personality for the people. No argument. But Calvin, in his personal dealings with people, had nobody that was warmer toward people than him. If you ever have a chance to read Calvin's letters, do you have them in your library? It's an education to read his letters. If you ever get the idea that Calvin was a stony, cold-hearted theologian, forget it. He cares for widows who've lost their husbands. He cares for young girls who have been betrayed. He cares for children left orphan, as orphans. He cares for every problem of life. He was a pastor to his people. He was not cold-hearted. And Philip Hughes, a few years ago, edited the records of the company, Geneva, the pastor's company. The whole book is worth reading. But if you read nothing else, read the closing chapter where the company of pastors at Geneva knows that Calvin is dying. And they come to him the last time. And if that doesn't move a cold heart, nothing will. This idea that Calvin was cold-hearted is blasted by reading that last chapter. I suppose that you've read it. One of the most moving chapters in all of Reformation literature, which I have any personal knowledge. Moving because it shows Calvin praying for his people, for the pastors, and the pastors in tears as they pray for themselves and for Calvin, not for his afterlife, but that they know their master's leaving them. And if you think those pastors at Geneva thought he was cold-hearted, you've never had the opportunity of reading that last closing chapter of Philip Hughes' book, which is nothing but an historical record of the company of pastors. Stern when he had to be? Yes. Soft-hearted when he had to be? Yes. Loving at all times. Even the famous duel he had with Servetus has been grossly exaggerated, grossly misunderstood, and I might say grossly perverted by historians whose chief zeal is to pervert and not to pronounce the truth on that famous antagonism. between, allegedly between Bethe on one hand, Calvin, of course, and Servetus. I don't have time to go into that. I do want to point, yes, sir. I do not know your name, sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. Not many people know this, and I'm sure you haven't come across this yet, because I know that my colleague here is not Kundra, but not until 1555 was Calvin a citizen of Geneva. He had no standing in the law of Geneva. He couldn't prosecute Servetus.
That's not true.
No, sir.
He didn't.
As a matter of fact, he spent the whole night before Servetus' death pleading with Servetus to accept the Lord Jesus Christ. Pleading with him. Secondly, as you may remember, since he was not a citizen at the time of this, the death penalty was invoked by the three councils of Geneva. There were three councils, 24, 60, and 300. And the councils, in not too nice language, told Mr. Calvin that they were the political source of authority, and if he'd keep out of their business, they'd greatly appreciate it. He could run the church, but they were running the political life of Geneva, and they had judged that Servetus was a political enemy of great danger, and he was, that they would handle Servetus. And this has been grossly misrepresented. Calvin pleaded with that man to accept the Lord Jesus Christ. Spent the whole night with him. You're welcome. I can attest to that. If you get the record, you'll see it. Calvin was warm-hearted when he needed to be. He was a great educator. And I would emphasize this. There's much that I could say. What time is it?
We have 15 minutes.
15 minutes. Let me now, unless there's another question, evaluate his work at Geneva. I gave you a brief reduction of the popular view of what Geneva was like. And Europe had very little respect for Geneva at the time that Calvin went there. Calvin, of course, then became the great preacher. He became the great commentator. He became the great letter writer. He became the great administrator. And frankly, students, I do not see, personally, how he ever was able to do what he did. When he announced his sermon, it wasn't a 20-minute sermon, with the congregation watching the watch to see if he preached beyond 12 o'clock so they could get the Howard Johnson on time. Not at all. His sermons were an hour and a half and 2 hours. He didn't preach once in the Lord's Day. He preached at least twice and sometimes three times. And that was not the end of his service. He preached throughout the entire week, because they had a great deal of preaching in Geneva. He preached and preached and preached his heart out to his people. As an educator, he and his assistants brought into being the Geneva Academy and the University of Geneva, rewrote the curriculum, and I would make this here another very important point. I don't think that we realize what the Reformation, and I'm including Lutherans, did for education. I said that only the Middle Ages could bring forth a university. That needs a slight amendment, that the Reformation continued the medieval tradition of a university, but improved it. With the great help of Melanchthon, Luther and Melanchthon together reformed the University of Wittenberg, the entire German school system in the part of Germany over which they had control. And Geneva became the model for English education, for Oxford and its reorganization, for Cambridge and the Thomas Cartwright and the great Puritan movement in England. Geneva became the educational center of non-German Reformation Europe. Sometime, if you have time, and I suppose you have these in your library, I don't know what you have and what you haven't got, get the records of the University of Geneva and the Geneva Academy and see what they did. You haven't come to this yet, I'm sure. But again, back to Calvin's warmth. When Calvin went to law school to study, at night, by the flickering
light of a long fire, he began the study of Greek. While he was doing that, he fell into a friendship with a 9-year-old boy, Theodosia, who, by the same flickering light of the same fire, was studying Greek at 9 years of age. That was the beginning. I know some of you, you laugh, and you should laugh, because I laugh with you. Can you imagine today many 9-year-old boys sitting by the light of a flickering live fire, eager to learn the Greek alphabet and able to learn the Greek New Testament? Unbelievable. But that was the beginning of a lifelong friendship between the older Calvin and the younger Theodore. And also with the professor, Mathieu Nicodier. So that when Calvin opened the academy at Geneva, he and Bisa called their old professor into service to take over and to become the rector. The impact of Geneva, not only on theology, but on education, is unbelievably great. The real reason, the underlying reason for the great problem in education in this country today and other countries is the fact that we lost sight of the glow of Reformation theology. We lost sight of the glow of education in the Reformation. Only in the Christian theistic tradition of the Middle Ages and the Reformation can you have a university. Today we have at best multiversities. And I say that as a kind of criticism, because I am a critic of modern education, and I become increasingly critical of modern education when I see what is happening to it, and it's virtually at an end. But Geneva, Wittenberg, Cambridge, Oxford, and other universities set forth the glowing lamp of true biblical education in the days of the Reformation. Yes, sir. Yes. The universities came into existence somewhere around 1170. I'm not here to discuss whether it was the work of Abelard or not, but whether we agree with St. Thomas Aquinas or not, and I don't on some points. Let me at the same time emphasize this, that the medieval mind was a cathedral. The medieval cathedral is the architectural reflection of the medieval mind. The university is the educational reflection of the medieval cathedral mind. St. Thomas to God, his whole summas are directing man's thoughts to God. I'm not arguing about his apologetics, I don't accept them. But I would never deny that St. Thomas, and he's 5'5", no matter how you look at him, was a theist. He was directing the mind of man to God. The medieval university was directed to that sort of thing. We've neglected medieval university. And we fail to realize that the Reformation University came out of it. Purified it? Yes. Developed it? Yes. A university is a school, an advanced school of learning, with a unified central concept, which we call Christian theism. And that is why the Middle Ages produced the university. Today, I mean no insult to Ole Miss. I would even include Chapel Hill, which is the height of treason, because one dare not speak of Chapel Hill except in due reverence and awe. We are multiversities because every department has its own frame of reference. If you have 70 departments, you have 70 frame of references. No, that's not true either. Within each department, every professor has his own frame of reference. So we actually don't have even a multiversity. We have confusion. Have I defined the term sufficiently in the time allotted to me? Now, yes.
Say a word about two other gifts of Calvin. The system systematic theology.
I was just going to come to that.
And then, if you have time, something about the structure for the church and for discipline.
Good. I didn't know how far I could go, Dr. Freud, and I must admit I got sidetracked on education because it's so fascinating to me, and Reformation education is a neglected field. Now, you first wanted
The theology.
Yes. Okay. In 1536, the first edition appeared. In 1559, the last edition appeared. The Institutes of the Christian Religion, in my humble opinion, is the single greatest treatise on the scriptures ever produced by the mind of man under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Some people will say it was an innovation that Calvin spun off the top of his head, which is, of course, ridiculous. In my little book, which I originally wrote before I had to change it, as I wrote it for an article for the Encyclopedia of Christianity, John Calvin, His Roots of the Scriptures, it was my main idea to not to treat Calvin systematically as a theologian, but to show two basic ideas. One, his roots. Two, his fruits. Leaving Calvinism as a theological product to other scholars to write on that thing. But, you see, when you take up Calvin, I have a study ready for publication, but hopefully someday, on Calvin's use of Augustine. There are at least 400 references to Augustine in John Calvin. Anybody who says that Calvin got his theology out of the top of his head knows no Calvin. Calvin knew Augustine probably better than anybody else, including Luther. Calvin went back to all the early Western fathers. I would say that next to Augustine, his theology is based upon Bernard of Clairvaux and Anselm. And he had a higher respect for St. Thomas Aquinas than many people are willing to admit. But he is in the Western theological tradition. Charles Hodge, in his Systematic Theology of Three Volumes, very often refers to Calvinism as Augustinism. And you can see why. Because, in my opinion, you have, in the year 430, a great height in theological achievement in Augustine, and then a general decline down through the post-Thomas. And then, in 1536, there appears that brilliant light in which Augustinism comes to its full development, like a glow over the Alps, lighting up not only Geneva, but all of Switzerland, France, ultimately Scotland, England, Hungary, Poland, and the northern Italy. On the Sabbath day? No. Augustine did not treat that subject very deeply. Augustine and Calvin wrote from different angles. Augustine was preserving the church against its pagan enemies, of which there were many. He was defending the church against the charge that it had caused the fall of Rome. He was writing against the Donatists. He was writing against the Manichaeans. He was writing against all the heresies that were outside the church. Whereas Calvin was writing against the Roman Catholic position. You've got to remember that. I can only answer that briefly at this point. Calvin provided the church with its first really systematic theology. As great as Augustine was, and I would insist upon his greatness, Calvin takes Augustine, Anselm, and the other Western fathers and brings them into a systematic position, starting not with man, as Luther did, man's problem, but starting with the doctrine of Almighty God and the epistemological issue of how do we know God, who is God, what are his attributes, what are his characteristics, and then coming from there to man, which, in my opinion, is the proper approach to theology. And this is, of course, the last great difference between Calvin and Luther, in that with Calvin, you have a systematic theology, which is a systematic statement of biblical truth. I know that today our existential friends, our Orthodox friends, poo-hoo this. But you see, the funny thing is that when they write against it, they must adopt a systematic propositional approach for the negation of a systematic statement of biblical truth. They have to, by the very nature of the case. They have to use that which they try to negate. I cannot overemphasize to you in the life of the church the role of systematic theology. Properly taught, as it is here, properly applied, as it must be, Calvin provided all the churches, to the extent they would use it, with a systematic theology. This is his crowning contribution to the life of the church. This is what has made Reformed theology so enduring. This is what has brought this school into being. This is what has brought Presbyterianism as a whole into being. May I make this closing statement? I don't have time to all you want. Will you note with me, if you read the attacks on Christianity, that the attacker, whether he be David Hume, Voltaire, Karl Barth, or any other modern scholar, or I meant 18th century critic, 17th century critic, 19th century critic, including Karl Marx. What system of theology is always attacked first? Calvinism. Do you know why? If the enemy can overthrow Calvinism, the rest of the edifice will collapse. There are only three theologies in the Western world: Roman Catholic Thomism, Lutheranism, and Calvinism. Calvinism maintains the entire evangelical structure. And evangelical fundamentalists who do not like Calvin and who are intent upon making their churches as un-Calvinistic as possible live off the rich blood of Calvinistic theology. If they could attack it, if its critics can attack it, and somehow wipe Calvinism off the face of the theological map, evangelical theology will collapse. So will Roman Catholic theology. Because Calvinism is the lifeblood of the thinking of the church in the proper relationship and the proper interpretation of the scriptures. We are the foundation of Western theology. And I would have you students who are in school studying for the Christian ministry remember that. Don't ever blush or say, "Oh yes, I'm a Presbyterian," but you know, I've seen people do this. And you hear people do it. Do I believe in predestination? Sure. Do I believe in coordination? Yes. In my first lecture, I will try to show you why Calvinism is necessary for any meaningful view of history. And when you surrender Calvinism, you have surrendered God's interpretation of history.